Thanks, Eileen.
It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Wash your hands.
Good afternoon. It is Friday, guys. The weekend is here. Hope you're in good form. You can let me know and keep me company. 51551 or ray@rte.ie. Sad news, though, this afternoon. You would have heard Prince Philip has passed away, 99 years of age. The news broke just after 12 o'clock, I think. And listening to the tributes and the reports there, they were married for 73 years. I mean, that is a lifetime. That's longer than some people live. And I actually met Prince Philip. Well, I didn't meet him. I shook his hand as he walked past. It was back in 2011 for that historic visit with the Queen. So he would have been 89 back then. And I do remember being blown away by how sprightly the two of them were, because if you remember, it was a grueling schedule and a lot of outfit changes for her on a daily basis. But I was reporting for the John Murray Show for Radio 1 at the time, and I followed them around for a few days. And but again, one of the most memorable parts of that for me was I was invited into government buildings when former Taoiseach Enda Kenny and his wife Fionnuala had them in for a chat and a cup of tea. But we had climbed the stairs in government buildings just before they got there. And the stairs, it's like a big sweeping stairs that then veers left and right and then has another return. So it's three sets of steps. And watching the two of them go up, they went up the middle of the steps. They'd neither of them held on to the banisters at the side, and they weren't linking arms, nothing. They just went up on their own. And I had gone up about 5 minutes beforehand, holding on to the banisters. But I remember being taken aback at how fit and healthy he was. But I will be chatting to former President Mary McAleese in a couple of minutes, getting her thoughts on his passing, as well as former BBC Royal Correspondent Jenny Bond as well. But before that, yes, I got this email in overnight from a listener who's looking for your advice. OK, so let's see, can we help her? It's from Anna, and she says, please don't read out my last name. So, of course, I won't. Dear Catherine, I enjoyed your chat the other day with rugby player and vet Elise O'Byrne-White. You said that she's living her dream, doing two jobs that she loves. And it got me thinking, I'm 42. I'm single and I'm not doing a job that I love. And as COVID hopefully comes to an end, I'm thinking, should I move country? Should I move country and start again? I lived abroad in my 20s and absolutely loved it. But my question is 42 too old to move country and start again? I know sometimes you ask your listeners for advice, as the song goes, should I stay or should I go? Thanks, Catherine. So let's get some thoughts from you guys. 51551 or ray@rte.ie. I'm going to start, Anna, right, and give you my tuppence worth, because I think if you have an inkling like that and you have an itch and a desire for new horizons and you're not happy where you are, like, why let fear get in the way of potentially living a happier existence? You know what I mean? Like, you've been locked down for more than a year, and it must be very tough when you're on your own. And actually, I'm going to be chatting in a couple of just within the hour to Aoife McIlwain about loneliness in the pandemic. So stay tuned and listen to that as well. But you say you travelled in your 20s and you loved it. And yes, it will be a different experience 20 years later. But there are so many ways now to integrate into communities and to feel connected and to be able to reach out. And you could commit to 2 or 3 years and always move back. So that would be my thoughts. And as the quote goes, being brave isn't the absence of fear. Being brave is having that fear, but finding a way through it. So I would say go for it. But I'd love to, because my sister moved back. She moved to the States. She's in her late 30s. She moved to the States, was there for 7 years, moved back in the pandemic, loved it, but it still is keeping her options open and her mind open to possibly moving again. But I'd love to hear from anybody who maybe has moved back or set up a new life here after a long time away, or maybe you're listening abroad having relocated. Let's give Anna some help. 51551 or ray@rte.ie. Because actually, when you think about it, a lot of people have moved back home after so long, back to villages and towns where they left and don't know anybody. I mean, there's possibly an old connection there, but a lot of people are starting again. And I think if you're going to do it, it is the right time to do it. So that's my thoughts on that. As I said, it's Friday. Many people thinking about the L takeaway. What are you getting? Have you planned it already? Let me know if any of you are getting a Rappo this evening. Exactly. That's what I thought. What in the hell is a Rappo? But you probably only know what a Rappo is if you live in Cabra, because according to the Twitter thread that I got lost in this morning, the Rappo originated in Cabra, and essentially it's phyllo pastry stuffed with rice, curry sauce and chicken. And I don't mind telling you, it looks delicious. And I was reading through the thread, and before anyone texts in to say, oh no, I've been eating them, it's different to a curry roll, apparently, which is battered and deep fried. So the Rappo is in phyllo pastry. So let me know what's your go-to dirty Friday night takeaway? Or actually, if your local takeaway does its own distinct delicacy, because that's kind of becoming a thing now. And it's kind of becoming a social media trend that people, I know local takeaways are doing their own dishes. So let me know, 51551 or ray@rte.ie. All I know now is I can't stop thinking about chipper chips. But there you go. Staying with food for a few moments, Marie-Claire Digby has a great piece on microwaves, of all things, in the Irish Times today that I thought was quite good, because we can be very snobby about microwaves, can't we? But she talks to chefs. Well, first of all, she clarifies and goes into the science of why they're safe, which I think is a concern for a lot of people. But she talks to a lot of chefs who have specialised their dishes and particular dishes around the microwave. So they're not just for reheating. You can actually produce some gourmet dishes if you know what you're at. But she gives a list of 10 things you can do in your microwave. So it's kind of like microwave hacks or kitchen hacks and bits and pieces. So I'll give you a few of them. Apparently, if you put citrus fruit in for 15 or 20 seconds and then squeeze it, it makes it much easier to juice, and you also get more juice as well. Chef Aidan McGee has a tip that you could place a vanilla pod in the microwave for about 15 seconds and it intensifies the flavour. It's much easier than to scrape out the seeds. And when you place the pod into sugar for vanilla sugar, apparently it's a much better flavour. There you go. Sarah Breslin, how to cook rice, which is something that not very many of us are good at. I just never know. Too much water, not enough water, too much rice. But anyway, she says, perfect rice in the microwave. One mug of basmati rice, two mugs of boiling water, large glass bowl, bit of sugar, bit of salt, bit of butter. Lash it in for 10 minutes. Stir it. Lash it in for another 2 minutes and leave it steam for 2 minutes. Perfect rice. So there you go. And Claire Ronan has a tip. If you want to clean your microwave, cut a lemon in half, put it in a saucer of water and put it on full power for 3 minutes. Apparently it leaves it sparkling. That's a job for me now this weekend. What else did I see? Yes, oh my gosh, there is the most adorable video going around at the moment. We've actually put it up. I think we've put it up, have we, on our Twitter feed? We have. And it is this gorgeous, adorable golden retriever, right? And he's sitting on the couch watching a Star Wars film, and all is good until Darth Vader appears on the screen, and the dog is so visibly terrified that he immediately climbs off the couch and he hides behind the couch and he continues to kind of peep his little head out and watch the movie from behind the couch. And even Luke Skywalker, Mark Hamill himself, has tweeted about it saying, smart dog, I only wish I thought of hiding behind the couch when I first met him. So it's gone viral, but it's so cute. Have a look at it. And it got us chatting on our Zoom meeting this morning about things that spook our pets. And my two are just regular scaredy dogs. You know, the doorbell goes and they go mental. And if the doorbell goes, if we're watching a movie or the television and there's a doorbell that sounds, that sends them off as well. But I don't think anything too freaky. Not as freaky as Neil's cat. Who, Neil came home from his Debs wearing a tuxedo, and the cat had never seen him in a tux or a suit before and absolutely freaked out. Somebody else, it was the click-clack of the high heels. I can't remember who of the team, but the dog used to freak out with the sound of high heels. Yeah, my friend, actually, it's when she puts the kettle on, that the dog hates the sound of the kettle going on. So anyway, let me know if you have anything that freak your pets out. 51551 or ray@rte.ie. The other thing that gets my dogs on, if I'm dancing around the kitchen and music really loud, I don't know if they're excited or freaked out. But anyway, this is a great song to turn up. This is Sinead O'Connor. That is the amazing Sinead O'Connor there with Mandinka and loads. And this is why I love radio as well, when we get emails like this. So such a big reaction to Anna's email. And I hope you're listening, Anna. One texter says, I'll be moving to Italy on my own soon. I'm 60, female and single. No reason to stay in Ireland if you don't want to. Another, I moved to Canada when I was 19 in 1972. I had family and a great life. But then after 41 years, I retired back to Ireland in 2013 and I love it. Somebody else says, why does she need to leave Ireland to change job? Yeah, that's a good point. And it was something that I actually should have said or forgot to say when I was talking earlier, because regardless of whether you decide to move or not, I think you really need to, if you don't move, I think you need to focus on reinvigorating yourself with a new job and a new career, and maybe that's enough, you know. Siobhan says, my great aunt Kitty emigrated to South Africa age 90 and loved life there for another 17 years. Go on, Kitty, you good thing. Mary says, I can't really see what age has got to do with anything. It's never too late to start living your best life. That lady should feel the fear and do it anyway, as Susan Jeffers would say. She should rent out her home to cover her mortgage and not cut all her ties. She should rent for a year in a new homeland, and if she loves it, still she can consider the full commitment. 42 is still young. She might add years to her life, as happiness is the key to longevity. Go girl, says Tracy from Clondalkin. Love that. My parents moved to Australia in their 60s. They found it difficult at first, but now they have a great social life and look about 10 years younger. They are an inspiration. So loads more coming in there, and we'll get to a few more of them. I want to get to a few doggy and cat ones. Yes, my cat Rusty legs it when I'm putting my winter coat on every single time, says Emmett. In Dublin, our dog Winston doesn't like shadows. He literally barks at his own shadow. That actually reminds me, there was another video doing the round a couple of months ago of a little toddler who was looking at her shadow. Oh, it was so funny. And freaking out every time she saw herself. My dog gets freaked out when Justin Bieber comes on the radio. Ooh, there you go. Along with the doorbell, what freaks my dog out the most last week was when Ray kept playing the clip of the dog barking at the Angelus. Very good. All right, keep them coming in. 51551 or ray@rte.ie.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, let me tell you about our quiz of today, which we've been running all week. And the prize is for a two-night stay in the fabulous Faithleg Hotel in Waterford. Four-star property. You can enjoy the drives, the coastal drives, beaches, cycling trails, all on the doorstep of this beautiful hotel, with dinner one night in the Roseville Rooms restaurant. Faithleg.com is the website, so you can find out all of the information there. So we're looking for two players, as always. And this is the question that you've got to answer today. In which Irish county would you find the town of Dundalk? In which Irish county would you find the town of Dundalk? So you can phone 1850 715 900. That's 1850 715 900. And we'll put two people up on the line after four to be in with a chance of winning that prize. And who doesn't want to get away for a few days, as we've been saying all week? So best of luck with that. Okay, following the announcement of the death of Prince Philip earlier today, former President Mary McAleese joins us on the line now to pay tribute. Thanks for joining us, Dr. McAleese.
My pleasure. How are you?
I'm really good. So tell us about your memories of Prince Philip, and when did you first meet him?
I first met him 2 years before I became president, back in 1995, when I was invited to a small lunch in Buckingham Palace to talk about events in Northern Ireland. There were maybe 8 or 10 of us around that table. I was sitting beside him, and that was my first introduction to him, apart from having seen him on television.
Okay.
He was incredibly engaging company. He was really good fun, not in the least bit grandiose or difficult, quite the opposite. No edge to him at all. Very, very easy company. Mm. But most importantly, I think, on that day was the first day I discovered the extent to which both he and his wife were very, very, very well read on Irish history, very up to date on contemporary politics on the island of Ireland, and really very anxious to make some kind of contribution, an important contribution to reconciliation.
Mm-hmm. And he made so many visits to Northern Ireland as part of his partnership, and the Duke of Edinburgh Award is such a big part of his legacy.
The Duke of Edinburgh Award is one of his great legacies.
Yeah.
He had that great capacity to be interested, always genuinely interested in young people and in opening up them to themselves and their capabilities and opening them up to the world. And of course, the whole idea of the Duke of Edinburgh's award is that people take on a challenge.
Mm.
And the competition is with yourself. It isn't with anybody else. Our award, the Gashka, the President's Award, is part of the international award system that he set up. But it was operating in Northern Ireland. We were operating Gashka here, of course.
Mm.
There was no ill will between the two systems, but they weren't really in what you might call a dynamic partnership. But he was anxious so was I, that they would get into a dynamic partnership. And he was so helpful, so unbelievably helpful. In fact, I ended up, at his request, I presented Duke of Edinburgh Awards in a ceremony in Belfast. And then he came to Dublin and he presented Gashka Awards at a ceremony in Dublin. Mm. And that gives you some idea, some sense of his openness to things. Because I think that he was the very opposite of po-faced, even though for a lot of his life he had to stand quietly, you know, one step behind his wife, say nothing or say very little. But when he had the opportunity to converse and to talk and to be interested in people, which he always was, he was really good company. Mm. He was, and people, in Irish terms, he was easy company.
Easy company. And people talk about, you know, the gaffes or whatever, but he did seem to have a great sense of humour.
Look, you know, over almost 80 years having cameras trained on your every single moment, if he had the odd gaffe, you know, I would say he could be forgiven a lot, because over his lifetime of service as the Queen's loyal partner over 8 decades, he can't be equaled. Mm. He simply can't be equaled. And I've been privileged to be in the company, in their company, just Martin, myself, and the Queen and Duke of Edinburgh, and to see the real easy banter, easy affection between the two of them that can only come from a loving relationship. You can't put it on.
I know. And when you think of how
you
long...
You can't put it on.
And such a long marriage. You've obviously sent sympathies to the Queen.
Well, 74 years they are married, you know. Yeah. And I think of in a small way of my own relationship with Martin. Martin and I are together 50 years. We're over 40 years married now. Right. And in the years when I was president, how important it was to me to have someone that you could really rely on, someone who was always there for you, someone who kept you going through thick and thin, who had your back, and who was always there to be talked to in the evening, and so you weren't lonely. Mm. And I think actually of her in a very special way today, because I think with his passing, her life is going to enter a period of real loneliness.
Yeah, God, yeah, of course. I have to ask you, Dr. McAleese, meeting Martin McGuinness, obviously, that was a symbolic moment. And
wasn't that very telling, Catherine, of the kind of person you were dealing with?
Yeah.
I mean, when they came to Ireland on the state visit in May of 2011, they were more than willing to meet anybody from Sinn Féin, and indeed did meet the Sinn Féin mayor of Cashel. Mm. But the fact of the matter is that Sinn Féin were opposed to the visit, stayed opposed to the visit, instructed their people not to meet anybody to do with the royal visit, even though we tried our very best. But the Queen herself and Prince Philip were more than open to meeting anybody that we recommended to them. And anyways, it was Sinn Féin didn't turn up for that occasion. But a year later, Martin McGuinness felt that he was able to meet them. And as you know, he met them in the Lyric Theatre in Belfast. Mm. And what's very telling is, you know, Prince Philip met him, shook his hand, and when you think of what he suffered, only what the Queen suffered, but what he particularly suffered with the loss of his uncle, Lord Mountbatten. Because if you look at the life that Prince Philip had, it was not an easy life. From early childhood, from he was a little baby, his life was disrupted by violence, by war. His poor mother taken off. Who was profoundly deaf, and I have a great sensitivity to that, coming from a family with a profoundly deaf brother and knowing how much ignorance there has been over the years of people who suffer from deafness. And he had to live with all of that, and his mother being taken away from him and consigned to what they would have called in those days an asylum, and he not being told any of that. And I remember having a conversation with him at Windsor on the return state visit by President Michael D. Higgins. And it was a conversation I wasn't expecting to have with him, to be honest. And I've had quite a few over the years, but this one was different because we were talking about the state of the various churches, and in particular the Christian churches and the Catholic Church at the time, with all the scandals and the people walking away. And he said a thing to me that I thought was quite remarkable. He said, but without faith, what have we got? Where do our values and our principles come from? He said, it means so much to me. Mm. And he was a man, you know, he didn't parade it. He didn't go around, you know, making a big deal about it any more than he went around making a big deal about anything. He did his duty without being cold-faced or pugnacious. A little bit mischievous from time to time, who could blame him? And with a great sense of humour. But behind it all, a man of really deep values and principles. And you can see that in how he treated his role as the consort of the Queen, and how he used his time to empower the young.
Mm. Well, listen, thank you for your words. I can't let you go, though, without asking you about what is happening in the North at the moment.
It's heartbreaking. It's Groundhog Day. It's deja vu. It's all of that. It's exactly what we thought. We hoped we had moved away from, but clearly haven't. And it shows that there's a huge amount of work to be still done in investing in young people, and in particular, the young people who are most estranged from, you know, from mainstream life. You can't overlook them. You can't forget them. And you do that at your peril. Because if you do that, there's a vacuum that is filled then by people who fill their heads with fake news and fake victimhood and nonsense. And I was just talking to a friend of mine the other day who has now had to get up and leave his home, you know, a Catholic living in a Protestant area with his Protestant wife. And they've had to get up and leave their home. I just don't want to see those days back. I just don't want to see those days back. So everybody who can has to hold hands together now, no matter what their faith, no matter what their politics or their political ambition, everybody of goodwill has got to gather together, hold hands and say, you know, form a phalanx against this developing any more than it has developed. It can't be allowed.
No.
It cannot be allowed to run into a wild bushfire like it did and has done so many times in the past, so many times. So I'm hoping that this is a wake-up call to everybody, including those adults who are, you know, quite, you know, just really, who are using these young people as fodder. And the young people don't understand it. They, you know, my grandmother always used to say, what's learnt in childhood's engraved on stone. Mm. And somebody has engraved really badly on these young lives. And they need better. They deserve better.
Absolutely. Dr. McAleese, thank you so much. Always a pleasure to chat to you.
And you too, Catherine.
And thanks for your words today. We're going to chat to Jenny Bond, former BBC Royal Correspondent as well. Jenny, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you, yeah.
Listen, I mean, was Prince Philip's death expected? I mean, he had been quite unwell and he had a long stay in hospital recently.
He did. He was in hospital for a month, longer than any other stay had ever had. And being the great age he was, 99, I think perhaps there was a feeling he was released from hospital to be sent home, hopefully to recover. But I don't think it could be a surprise that he succumbed to frailty of extreme old age.
Mm. And just listening to Dr. Mary McAleese there, she talked about in the many times that she met them, their partnership between himself and the Queen seemed strong. Was it?
Oh, yes, it really, really was. I mean, she fell head over heels in love with him when she was very young, and he fell in love with her more gradually, I think, but it was the strongest relationship, and for that I think the Queen will be immensely grateful today, that she has had more than 70 years with the love of her life. But she will also be incredibly sad, I suppose. We must think that these last few months of the pandemic have brought one thing for her, which is brought her husband to her side, because when he retired from formal duties in 2017, he spent a lot of time at Sandringham, next to the big house, a place called Wood Farm. It's a lovely house, and he would stay there and he would paint and entertain a few friends and read a great deal. But the Queen was still working, so she was often in London. So they were apart a great deal, but the pandemic has brought them together. So they have spent their last months, except when he was in hospital, together at Windsor Castle, which, again, must be a comfort for her on this very, very sad day.
Yeah. And can I ask you, did he like being a royal? Like, did it sit comfortably with him?
Well, I mean, he was more royal than the Queen. He was a prince of Greece. He was a prince of Denmark. He honestly had so much royal blood in him. He was descended from Queen Victoria, just as she was. You know, he was a distant cousin of the Queen, of the woman he married. So royal blood ran through him. But I don't think what he didn't like were the strictures of the rather stuffy court life, which he found himself bound up in when he married the Queen or married Princess Elizabeth, and she became Queen, and all of a sudden there was this stuffy old place to move into, Buckingham Palace, full of old men who didn't want anything to be changed. And he was a young man, full of energy and verve, and a moderniser. He wanted things to be done more efficiently. Mm. So he went round. He went into every room in Buckingham Palace, and it's a big old place, you know, and opened every door and said, OK, who are you? What do you do now? How can we make things better? How can we make it work more efficiently? He was a man of action, a man who simply believed, don't whinge, don't complain, get things done.
And that's why even now at me just watching The Crown, you think you know everything. But he kind of struck me as a man who didn't like playing second fiddle. And exactly that, you describe him there going in, changing things, do that and do that. And yet he had to take the back seat for so long, since 1952 when he married her, and it was a very non-traditional role for a man to play second fiddle like that and follow her around and be at her side. Do you know what I mean?
Oh yeah, I mean, I think that was hard for him to bear, actually, but he did it with great grace, great dignity. I've travelled the world with them and seen how he has supported her on royal tours and made her laugh and lightened the mood. But I think that it worked so well as a partnership because the Queen was quite canny, and she made it absolutely clear to Philip that at home he was the man of the house, he was the boss, he was the head of the family. She said he was in charge of all the estates, so in Sandringham that was his world, you know, how things were done, how the estate was run, and at Windsor and Balmoral as well. So he had a very strong place as head of the family. And I think that was very wise of her, because he was a very proud man.
Mm. Would he have been sad at the exit of Harry and Meghan, or would he have yearned for their freedom?
I think he was exasperated by all that's happened with Harry and Meghan. From what I understand, he removed himself from that family crisis. In previous family crises, he has played a leading role. He used to write to Diana during the War of the Waleses, when the marriage was breaking up between Charles and Diana. He wrote long letters to Diana, and she wrote back, "Dearest Papa, thank you for your help." And he would write and say, "Well, I'm not a marriage counsellor, but I will do anything I can to help you and advise you." But with Harry and Meghan, from what I gather, he just felt he'd had enough. He was too tired, and he kind of walked away from the negotiations and left it to his wife and to Prince Charles to try to sort out.
I mean, when you think about it, because he has 8 grandkids, he has 10 great-grandkids. What sort of a grandfather would you say he was, or a great-granddad?
Pretty good, actually, I think. Obviously, with the great-grandchildren, he's been a very old man.
Yeah.
So maybe, you know, hasn't been knocking around with a football or whatever with them. But as a grandfather, very valued, particularly, I think, by William and Harry. Mm. Obviously, having lost their mother at such a young age, he was the one who helped them walk behind Diana's coffin.
I only read that this morning, that I think it was William that said, I don't think I can do it. And he said, if I walk beside you, would you do
Will
it?
You?
Yeah,
that's right. So he did. It was a long walk, and I wasn't a young man then. So he did that. And I think, I remember Harry said not long ago, he said that his grandfather was such a support to the Queen. He was like a fish swimming down the river, and sunlight, suddenly, sometimes he would go in the opposite direction, but he was incredibly important to the Queen. Mm. And he couldn't quite see how she would ever manage without him, which, of course, she now has to do. And I'll say something else, actually. I think it's extraordinary that the Queen, in these last few weeks, with her husband clearly very sick at home, even though he was out of hospital, but very frail at least, she's been carrying on her work. She's been doing a lot of calls on Zoom. She made a personal appearance a few days ago. she's looked very, very cheerful, very engaged. And yet all the time in the back of her mind, she must have known that her husband was ailing.
Well, listen, may he rest in peace. And we're all, of course, wondering, is Harry home? Is he coming home? Is he, you know...
Well, yes. We don't know quite when his baby is due. It's not far away, I don't think. But one would clearly expect him to be on the next flight home,
if he's not there already. Jenny Bond, listen, thanks for chatting to us today. Let's take a quick break.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Text 51551. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Loads more emails coming in and texts on the back of Anna's email, who was asking us and asking for advice on whether she should emigrate and move countries at 42. So I'm going to try and get to them after Nuacht. But first, lockdown has been difficult for each and every one of us. And yesterday I spoke to entrepreneur Gary Fox about how tough he found it as a business person and what he had been going through. But for people living alone, it has been very different and often a very lonely experience. Writer and creative events planner Aoife McIlwain lives in Connemara, and she joins us now to reflect on the last year in lockdown. Aoife, how's it going?
I'm doing great, Catherine. Thank you so much for having me on today.
Oh, not at all. It's lovely to chat to you. So you are living in Connemara now.
Yes, I am absolutely blessed to be surrounded by a beautiful space, even if I can't travel to it. I can always see it, which is really nice. The mountains are a great comfort, and so is the sea.
Where can I ask you where in Connemara?
I live just outside of Clifton Town.
Oh, fabulous. Beautiful. And in fact, well, we were just actually, I don't know if you heard the top of the show, but we had a listener who was putting a query out there as to whether she should move countries, whether she should relocate. And I had made the point that so many people had moved to different parts of Ireland or towns or villages to start a new life. But so you're there now. Before COVID, tell us like what your life was like. You were traveling, you were on the go with work.
Yes. Basically just before I actually moved to Clifton in January 2020, and I'd had a brilliant couple of years professionally, but some difficult times personally. I was very lucky. I had a very amicable mutual split from my husband, who is a lovely person, and as we say to each other, there's no one else I'd rather be divorcing. But
even in a
good breakup, there's a lot of grief involved. So
how long were you married?
We were together for 13 years, so it was a lot of growing up together, and our lives were very kind of intertwined. So I have always had a connection with Connemara since I was a teenager. And it's been a place that I've come back to recover, to heal, to retreat just many times in my life. So in January 2020, I came here for 2 weeks. And basically, I think I was here about 5 days. And I realized, I think this is where I need to be right now. So my life at the time was... I take January off because I'm an events planner, as you said. So I have a company called the Sing Along Social, which is basically a chaotic choir designed for people.
It is utterly fabulous.
Thank you, Catherine. So it's basically a choir for people who cannot sing, but over 5 years, we've kind of built it up to be, just a beautiful experience of wholesome crack and lots of different types of events, all the music festivals.
You do a lot of the festivals,
I said all, but you know, a good view, I should say, rather, and some festivals abroad, private parties, a lot of weddings. So basically, in January 2020, I had a gig in Cork, one in Dublin, and one on the Isle of Man. And I thought, listen, if I can make this work from Connemara, I think I can stay. I think I can make it work. I was traveling so much for work anyway, and I thought, especially because my job and doing gigs and being around people so much, it's incredible. And I loved it. It was my absolute dream job. But it also takes a lot of energy. So I knew that in my home life, if I could have a very quiet home life, that might kind of bring a bit of balance into it. But I definitely wasn't expecting it to be so quiet and so without all of those kind of sparkly people and gigs, because basically I got lucky and made the the move to Clifton kind of more permanently in February last year. And then a month later, we were in lockdown. And I was living alone for the first time in a new town, fresh from a breakup. Luckily, I had my little dog, Daffodil, with me. Aww. But also, I did, I guess the challenge was I had some... really old good friends here, and I guess the slight challenge was they were suddenly outside of my 2 kilometers. So, but in one way, it meant that I've really, really put down roots, I feel, in Clifton, and I wonder if I'd maybe had the opportunity to do that if I was traveling around and things like that. So,
but you make the point, though, and sorry to interrupt you, you make the point that you were looking, because of the life that you had, which involved travel and people and crowds and crack and all of that, that it was so important to have time alone. But actually, when what's happened to so many people is too much time on your own, that's when, you know, we all of a sudden go, oh my God, when we don't have contact with people, when we don't have friends within our 2K or our 5K or whatever, the reality of loneliness hits us like a ton of bricks.
Absolutely. And I'm an extrovert, and my experience of last year, there were some wonderful moments where I just loved being by myself. And, you know, I realized that it made things very uncomplicated in one way, because I could decide to have a 3-hour bath if I wanted to. And that was a great way to spend some of the days of lockdown. But there was also some extremely difficult times throughout the year where loneliness was chronic for me. And it became very, very, very isolating and very difficult, as I said. It's funny, it wasn't the first lockdown. That was okay for me personally. I found it very difficult when things opened up for the first time in the summer. It was like all of the energy that usually gets put into my creative events, it was completely misfiring all over the place. And it was kind of, I think I'd almost forgotten how to be around people. Mm. And then, so that was sort of a bit, that was uncomfortable. And I felt that that my ability to connect was being, it was just misfiring and it wasn't kind of fully functioning. And recently, I read a really fantastic book that just gave me so much insight into this, and I would recommend it to anyone who's feeling that pinch of loneliness. It's called Together: Loneliness, Health, and What Happens When We Find Connection. It's by Dr. Vivek H. Murthy, who was the Surgeon General in the US. And basically, he talks about how, as people, we are wired for connection. We've been evolutionarily, that's my word, designed to seek connection. If you think about how our ancestors, how much trouble they would have been if they had to survive alone, we're literally built to seek out connection from other people. And when we don't get it, it's there's something inside our brains that give us little signals that say, you need to seek connection. So what I really liked about how he put it is that if we could think about loneliness in the same way as we think about other vital needs. So when we're thirsty, we look yes. for a drink. If yeah. we're hungry, we look for something to eat. And if we're lonely, we should seek connection. So that can be, and from my own experience, being able to digitally connect with people in the last year, of course, has been really vital. And I was speaking to a very good friend this morning just over WhatsApp video again, like incredible to be able to see his face and speak to him over a good internet connection. And we were talking a little bit about how before COVID, we were sort of slowly moving towards a digital world. And what has happened now is we've been forced into complete digital life, digital world, and we maybe didn't kind of quite choose it. And what it maybe is showing up is like how fantastic it is to be able to use technology to continue to connect, but that there has to be a balance between the two. And the balance being completely in the digital world, just I can say from my own experience, that isn't enough of a connection to keep me well.
No.
So, and that might be different for other people. Again, this is my experience, but for me, being able to actually spend time with people, sharing like the simplest things. I didn't have a hug for 12 weeks last year and I think I took the first lockdown super seriously. I've taken them all seriously. I follow the guidelines and I try to protect myself and my community. But I've realized that I was really glad to see the idea of the social bubble being brought in, that has been essential for my recovery from loneliness.
And I'll ask you about that. It's like, who gave you your first hug or what was it like?
Yeah, so, oh my goodness, I will always remember it. So I was very lucky that I made new friends in the pandemic. So I swim with a group of sea swimmers here who were fantastic support all of last year. We were swimming on Clifton Beach, and basically, I also, because of my little dog, we walked almost every day with another dog owner called Dr. Claire Brown, who was a friend of a friend of mine. We didn't know each other at the start, but we were within each other's 2Ks. So that was an absolute lifeline for me to be able to walk with someone, because otherwise, like, I really wasn't seeing anybody at all,
yeah,
all day. So what that means is you can get stuck in your own thoughts, and you have I mean, self-reflection is an important thing, but there is definitely, it's possible to overdo it, and I can tell you that for sure.
And
so
I
it was
also
Dr. Claire Brown who gave me my first hug.
Oh, and I would also say as well, this is where the importance of dogs come in, because
yes,
you're like, because, you know, dogs are a way to connect with other people, dog walkers. You stop in Clifton and you have a dog. It's a way to kind of engage in conversation with people. I talk to more people when I'm with my dogs than when I'm not.
Oh, totally. And also, like, absolutely. I mean, and, you know, they offer a really special connection as well. And any pet can do that, you know. Well, maybe not fish. I don't know. Sorry to anyone. I'm sorry if I've offended fish owners. But
come here. Your situation has changed now in that you are part. You're living with a family. You're tell me about that. How has the situation changed?
Okay, well, so basically 3 weeks ago, I was walking on one of our beautiful beaches and I stood on the most innocent tiny little rock and I slipped and I broke my ankle in two places. And what is so funny, I think this really highlights how lonely I actually was, but basically, had to be rescued from the beach. It was so dramatic by the two paramedics and six local firefighters.
Oh, gosh.
And it was great. I must commend the local emergency services. We are so lucky. Then they were absolutely brilliant. I was raced into Galway Hospital. And it was the closest that I felt to being at a festival for a year and a half. Now, and I must say, I was in the hospital for a very good reason. I knew I was going to recover. The painkillers were also excellent. But what struck me about it is that it was so social. I met so many new people. I got to have so many chats. And again, big, big thank you to everyone at Galway Hospital for looking after me so well. But basically, I'm in a lovely pink cast now, and I'm in it for another 3 weeks. And so my very, very dear friends, Kalina and Patrick, invited me to join their family. And so I'm now their fourth oldest overgrown
child.
Teenager.
I love
yes.
it. It's amazing. And that's, again, it's just, it's so reassuring to hear how community comes together like that as well. I love it. I could chat to you all day, but unfortunately we've run out of time. We are getting a load of mail, text messages and emails in here looking for the name of that book again. The book that you said,
oh,
Together.
Yes, sure. Yeah, it's called Together, Loneliness, Health, and What Happens When We Find Connection, Dr. Vivek H. Murthy. And yeah, I would just say that, you know, to remember to seek support if you can. We often talk about reaching out, but what I would say is when you're chronically lonely, and Dr. Murthy talks about this in his book, it's really, really hard to reach out. So what I would say is if you know someone who's living alone, or if you could reach in, that is one of the best things that you could do, because, and that's the same for depression. So yes, reach out, but sometimes other people have to reach in to you as well. Yeah.
I love that. Well, listen, thank you so much for opening the conversation up today. And I think it's really hit home for a lot of people and helped a lot of people out. So enjoy your swim this afternoon, or well, you're probably not swimming at all at the moment now with your cast on. Nothing for a while yet. When you get back to it.
A small price to pay. Absolutely. For breakfast in bed. So
there you go.
I'm
fine. What's for dinner tonight?
Oh, something delicious, no doubt. But I won't be cooking. But anyway, thank you so much, Catherine. It's been a pleasure.
Aoife, lovely to chat to you.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Tweet at Radio Ray RTE. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, you might be familiar with the annual Incognito Art Sale in aid of Jack and Jill's Children's Foundation. Well, every year a host of famous names secretly create a piece of art, and that art goes on sale, all for a good cause. And you don't actually find out which artist you're buying until after you've bought it, which is a great idea. This year, painters include people like Bob Geldof and Tommy Tiernan, and Irish designer Paul Costello, who is on the line now from London. Good afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon, Catherine. On a sunny London, Sleeping Beauty is now opening its eyes, and things are quite positive over here at the moment.
Yes, you're getting ready to open and get back
on
to some
Monday.
Level of
yes,
normality.
Everybody is polishing their brasses and washing down their restaurant chairs, and everything seems to be, there's quite a nice atmosphere after a very long time.
I'd say Come here, I have to start by asking you about Prince Philip, because we were obviously chatting about him at the top of the show. Did you ever meet him, Paul?
I did quite a while back. We were doing a fashion show in the conference centre here in Dublin. It was a designer collaboration, and he came along with the Queen and he shook our hands, and it was all very nice. And I did mention to him that I had dressed his daughter Anne, but he was exactly a fashion victim, so he kind of just continued walking on. But he's a great man, like 73 years married to the same woman. That's pretty good, you know, for any of us, and having to walk behind her half the time. I have to give him credit, definitely, on that account.
Absolutely. And you'd been talking about the royal family this week. Obviously, you were close to Princess Diana. Do you think, I asked Jenny Bond this about Harry and Meghan, I mean, the interview that they did, will it have taught the royal family a thing or two? Or do you think now with today, are there big changes ahead?
I think there will be changes, but I also hope very much that Harry and Meghan will come to the funeral, which I think would be a great bonding moment. And I would really think... I'm sure it would be a great moment if they would, you know, still keep their single life, what they're doing. But I think that would be a great moment and a great opportunity to help all the matters and everybody concerned.
Mm. Okay, let's talk about the piece of art that you've created for the Incognito Art Sale in aid of Jack and Jill, because one lucky buyer is going to be taking home a Paul Costello original. Now, I was looking at them today and I couldn't make out, because I thought it would be quite obvious what yours was. I have a feeling, but I'm not going to say anything, obviously.
Yeah. Pretty, feminine and sweet,
yes.
Just like what I am. Yes, yeah, that was the one. Yes,
that was the one. It's a great initiative, though.
Well, it is a brilliant initiative, and some of these major painters like Robert Ballard, etc. You know, I was just making a note there. They could be putting money on the Grand National, £60, and if you get a Robert Ballard or any of these other great artists, you could get it. You know, the price would increase at least £600. So that's 10 to 1, and it might even go up higher. So for £60, it could be quite an investment as well. So I think it's overall it's a great opportunity. But we do hope that everybody will pay more than £60 to buy a painting, because it's such a worthy cause.
It
and
really is.
It's looking after 400 children suffering from terrible, terrible problems like Edwards syndrome, cerebral palsy, epilepsy, and my dearest friend, little Leo, who has Angelman syndrome. These are life illnesses. Mm. And I think it's just so important that not only for the children that Jack and Jill exist, but for the parents, because I think it gives the parents an opportunity to maybe go to the cinema, go out for a day, go for a walk.
Absolutely.
Give them marriage help
a
as well.
Yeah.
I think we must never forget that, because there's two in this. And it's and with all these wonderful qualified nurses who go into all the homes around the country, they are desperate for money, of course.
And fundraising has been so decimated this year as well.
Exactly.
So just to remind people, the collection is now live. You can look it up, incognito.ie, and the sale takes place Thursday, April 22nd at 10 a.m. sharp. I'm going to put my money where my mouth is, Paul, and try and nab what I think is yours. Lovely chatting to you today.
Back another horse. Yes.
Thanks, Paul. Nice chatting to you. Anish Toshe and I'm Dupree of Scalton, Anuk de la Marion the Hulawan. Marion, your advice is still coming in thick and fast for Anna. Ned and Carmel say, to your listener who is wondering whether to move overseas, we would say just do it. We're in our 50s, still working, and moved to Portugal 6 years ago. It's really great out here. It was easy to get settled in and the weather is certainly a bonus. Somebody else, I changed my career at 57. It's a job I wanted to do all my life and enjoy every day. It's never too late. Regarding the woman who wrote into you, Catherine, about going away and if she's too old at 42, I say no, she's definitely not too old. I went away at 47 for a few years and I have no regrets about this. I've since moved back to Ireland, and how you get on here, I believe, totally depends on your preferences and personal situation. So good luck to her in whatever she decides to do. Thanks for sending that in, Mary. Frank says, I'm listening in and this is my story now. I worked in Kuala Lumpur for 23 years. And came back home for my mom's birthday, walked into the lockdown. In 1996, I set up the first Irish pub in Malaysia. I'm now living on some great memories. Sad to have left some great friends behind, but I'm having run at a new start here, and the friends there are only a click away. Killian says, I have lived outside of Ireland for 20 years, Spain for 15, and 4 years in Colombia. The important thing is not to expect a change of country to change you on the inside. Change comes from within, as does happiness. But by God, you can't beat the weather abroad. Do it, do it, do it. So somebody else, I'm moving to Australia at 47. I wonder, is there some sort of a forum or some sort of like place that, like, you know, people who are emigrating, surely there's a platform there that all of these messages and people can connect with each other. I'm sure that's out there. Somebody else says, I'm listening in from Manchester. Your caller who is questioning moving at the age of 42 should absolutely do it. I lived in Australia from 2011 and made the decision to move back to the UK in July 2019. I moved to Australia in my early 30s, and while there were a few challenges with my age, there were many bonuses. It was easier to get a good job because I had more work experiences. I was more wise with money. I was more brave and adventurous. On the flip, moving home was a difficult decision, but it was the right one. I found my community again, and I love being back around family. Lots more coming in, and we'll try and get to a few more. But now it is time for our quiz. We've got our quizzers on the line, and let me just remind you of what they are playing for today. It's two nights in the fabulous Faithleg Hotel in Waterford in the sunny southeast. It's a 4-star hotel, and you get two nights, as I say, breakfast on both mornings, dinner on one night of your choice in the Roseville rooms. And I talked about how fabulous the Waterford Greenway is during the week as well. It's just incredible. 46 kilometres of off-road cycling along an old railway line between Waterford and Dungarvan. So absolutely fabulous. Faithleg.com is the email address. Now, who is going to be the lucky duck heading off today? We have two players on the line. We have Paddy from Belturbet in Cavan, and we have Geraldine from Dublin, but originally from Leitrim. Good afternoon, guys.
Good afternoon. How are you doing, Catherine?
Well, sure. Listen, I'm flying it. It's Friday, and I've got chipper chips on my mind. So life is good. Paddy, you are player one, so I'm going to start with you. How are you getting on? What's going on today? What are you up to?
Not too much. I just was doing converting the attic there for the last couple of days, and finished up today now. And the next part of it now is just putting two Velux windows in it.
Oh, and are you doing all this yourself?
Yep. Oh, yeah. I know.
Handyman.
Well, I'm a carpenter by trade, so I was, and then I went on to teaching.
Okay. So you're doing the full job. It's obviously an attic that you can. Can you stand in it? Like, are you putting the floor
in?
I'm afraid
you cannot stand in it. My knees are quite sore at this stage.
Okay, so it's just for a bit of extra storage, is it?
Exactly. That's exactly it, right.
Okay. And who's at home with you?
My wife, Carmen, is here, and two dogs.
Your wife and the two dogs.
Yeah.
Have you kids?
I have two kids. I have two kids, one in Dublin and one in London.
Okay. Oh, wow. Okay. So it's been a while since you've been visiting in London.
Well, no. You see, they were here for the last 2 years and they went back to London there about 3 weeks ago. We have one grandson and he's gone back to London on this as well.
Okay. And all this talk about emigration and people moving abroad, how is it having your child living abroad?
It could be worse. It could be further away. London's not too bad for us now. You know what I mean?
That's it.
We're here for the last 2 years, so it was very good then. So, he could be further away, and we're delighted that he's in London. Really, you know. And
yeah.
I think they're settled well in it at this stage anyway.
Yeah. And sure, look at once they're happy, you're happy. Isn't that what they say?
Well, that's the main thing. Yeah. We're not just happy. We'll be not seeing the grandson as often as we were, but sure, look at. That's life.
That's it. Stay on the line, Paddy. Geraldine, how are you, Geraldine? Are you good?
Hi. How are you doing, Catherine?
I am in flying form. I'm in flying form.
You sound great.
What?
You sound great.
So do you. What's going on today? What are you up to?
Well, I'm just in from a lovely walk out with a friend of mine, social distance, of course. We were out there walking along the seafront in Dunleary today, so it was lovely.
You didn't get caught
in fresh air,
You didn't get caught in the shower. There was an unmerciful shower before I came down.
We did in one, but we were well wrapped for, so we were all right.
Good. And come here, how has lockdown been for you? Are you coping? How are you staying sane?
Well, look, this is the big question, Catherine. It's amazing, you know, how I am. Yeah, I'm sort of now Zoom at this stage. Zoom is my other life, you know what I mean? This is it. Everything and anything on Zoom between courses and meetings and friends and you name it.
Honestly, I know.
As I say, trodding the concrete. That's it. I'm on my second pair of runners now. I've worn out the first pair, so...
Well, aren't you lucky that you get to walk Dunleary Pier?
Absolutely, yeah.
To have that on your doorstep.
I have to say, it's wonderful, yeah. It's near, within the 5K, you know, that's it.
Yeah.
And
what are the plans for the weekend? Anything exciting apart from Zooming?
Well, at the moment, nothing much really. I suppose I'll be walking as per usual and, a few little things, you know. The weekends are quieter. It's normally during the week that's quite busy, you know. They're the days that everything is happening really.
I find the weekends harder as well because you're trying to fill the days.
They can be a little bit, you know, I find them quiet, but I don't mind because the rest of the week, you know, can be busy with some days two and three things on, and I look forward then to the weekends, you know, kind of a bit of normality.
Well, listen, it's Paddy and Geraldine. Wish each other luck, lads.
Good luck, Paddy.
Good luck, Geraldine. All the best. Now.
Thank you so much.
All right, Paddy, we're going to start with you. And this is your first question. On this day in 1440, Christopher of Bavaria was crowned King of Denmark. What are the two colours on the flag of Denmark? Is it red and white or blue and white?
Red and white.
Is the right answer. Good man, Paddy. Geraldine, over to you. On this day in 1965, Helen Alfredsson, Swedish golfer, was born in Gothenburg. What are the two colours on the flag of Sweden? Are they blue and red or blue and yellow?
Blue and yellow.
Is the right answer. Good woman, Geraldine. Paddy, back to you. Take a listen to this.
My poor little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the colour of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
On this day, Paddy, in 1968, that African-American civil rights leader was buried in Atlanta. Can you name him?
Martin Luther King.
Well done. All right, Geraldine, over to you. Have a listen to this. Oh, brings me back. On this day, Geraldine, in 1986, that TV show you heard the theme tune to announced it would revive Bobby Ewing's character. Can you name the show?
Oh, indeed, Dallas.
Oh, who can forget it? Who can forget it? Paddy, would you have got that one right as well?
Yeah, you would have.
Okay.
Yeah, no.
Okay, back to you. This is your question. On this day in 1947, tornadoes struck the U.S. state of Oklahoma, injuring over 1,300 people. In total, how many U.S. states begin with the letter O? Is it two or three?
Two.
Is the wrong answer, Paddy. It's three. There's Oklahoma, Ohio and Oregon. All right. Hang on in there. It's still early days. Geraldine, back to you. On this day in 1960, Katrina Leskinich, American musician and singer with Katrina and the Waves, was born in the U.S. state of Kansas. In total, how many U.S. states begin with the letter K? Is it two or three?
Two.
Is the right answer, Geraldine. Kansas and Kentucky.
Kentucky, yeah.
Yeah, well done. All right, Paddy, take a listen to this. You can go your own way. You can call it another lonely day. On this day, Paddy, in 2018, that group you heard announced new members Neil Finn and Mike Campbell after firing long-standing member Lindsay Buckingham. Can you name the group?
Oh, yeah. Is it Fleetwood Mac? No.
That is correct and right. One of the all-time greatest bands. Love them. All right, Geraldine, back to you. Take a listen to this. Okay, Geraldine, on this day in 1978, Rachel Stevens, singer with that group, was born in Southgate, London. Can you name the group?
No, Catherine, I don't
know.
No,
okay, no worries. It's S Club 7. That is the name of the group. No worries. Okay, so you're still neck and neck. Paddy, back to you. On this day in 2000 at the 53rd BAFTAs, The Sixth Sense starring Bruce Willis was nominated for a Best Film Award. In what year was Bruce Willis born? Was it 1951, 1955 or 1959?
51, is it?
That is the wrong answer, Paddy. 1955 is what we were looking for. He's 66 years of age. So you are at three. Now, Geraldine, no pressure. If you get this right, you are off to Waterford. If you get it wrong, we are into a tiebreaker. All right?
Okay.
Still with the BAFTAs, on this day in 2000, Michael Caine was nominated for a Best Supporting Actor Award for his role in The Cider House Rules. In what year was Michael Caine born? 1933, 1937 or 1940?
1940.
Is the wrong answer, Geraldine. It is 1933. Paddy's delighted. 1933, he is 88 years of age. Can you believe it? Okay, guys, that means we are neck and neck, which means we are going to our tiebreaker question. You were asked before you came on air. And the question was, on this day in 1917, legendary racehorse trainer Vincent O'Brien was born in Churchtown, County Cork. According to the AA route planner, how long would it take to drive from Churchtown in Cork to Killybegs in County Donegal? And we wanted the answer in hours and minutes. Can you remember what you said, Paddy?
I think I said 6 hours and 20 minutes.
You said 6 hours, 20. Geraldine, what did you say?
6 hours, 50 minutes.
You said 6 hours, 50 minutes. And the correct answer is 4 hours, 21 minutes. Which means, Paddy, you...
Well done. Well done, Paddy.
Our winner today.
Sorry, Geraldine.
No worries, Paddy. Well done, you.
Yeah, that's good. I know about it.
Fair play to you. Geraldine, we will be sending you a Ray Darcy Show mug.
Brilliant.
For your time today, and have a great weekend. Enjoy the rest of it. Paddy, you can stay
Thank
out of the attic
much.
Now for the rest of the afternoon. Are you delighted? Who are you taking to Waterford?
Oh, so I'll take Carmel's wife. Funny enough, I taught down there for a while. I taught the Dallas Island Waterford for a couple of years.
Okay, so you know the area well.
I know it well. Yeah, I know it very well. Yeah.
How are you?
Good to get back down after these years.
How are you on a bike?
I'm not too bad on a bike.
There you go. You've the whole 46 kilometres of the greenway.
Right, that's correct. They've a great greenway now. Yeah, that's right.
There you go. You listen, know. Congratulations. Enjoy
no
it.
No bother, Catherine.
You deserve
very much.
A nice few nights away. Thanks a million.
Thank
back
you,
after
thank
this.
You,
the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, the name Jacqueline Wilson will be a familiar name to lots of you. She is one of the most well-known children's authors in the world. Her Tracy Beaker series were the most borrowed books in the UK public libraries for a decade. She has a new book out now, The Runaway Girls, and she is on the line now. Good afternoon, Jacqueline.
Good afternoon, Catherine. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. How are you keeping?
I'm fine, thank you. I can't wait for Monday, because then some of our shops open up and I can go get my hair cut.
Oh.
I look like a yak at the moment. Thank God this is a radio.
It is the one thing so many of us are just, that's on the top of the bucket list, isn't it?
It really, really is, yeah.
I was just talking to Paul Costello there and he said they're dusting down the restaurant seats and washing the windows. So it feels like a bit of life returning to normal over there by the sounds of it. I've asked himself and anybody that I've been speaking to today about Prince Philip. Did you get to meet him, Jacqueline? Because I know you were appointed a dame for your services to children's literature back in 2008. But did you ever meet him?
I did meet him, yes. It wasn't when I was made a dame. That was the Queen.
Okay.
I feel very privileged to have met most of the royal family. But the royal family decided to have a series of events where they met people from different branches of life because it was felt that they needed to widen their sort of acquaintances, as it were. And they decided to do a grand do for everybody concerned with the world of books. And it was quite exciting to get an invitation and actually to go inside Buckingham Palace. And then there we were, about 200 or 300 people, all gathered together in one of the splendid rooms. And the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh came in and several other royals. And then they sort of weaved their way through the crowd, splitting up so that some people got to speak to one royal, some to another. And I was standing with a group of children's authors and a group of some other types of publishers. And we were all waiting, sort of chatting away, trying to be very blasé, but secretly wondering, oh gosh, what are we going to say when somebody comes up to talk to us?
And who's going to come up? Which one will we get?
Right. And the Duke of Edinburgh came up, and he was relatively elderly then, but I couldn't help thinking a fine figure of a man. He seemed to tower over all of us. And I mean, it must be agony to be a royal because you've got to start making conversation. That's the etiquette. They start you first. And so, you know, sort of snatching something to say, he said, and what do you all do? How are you to do with the world of books? And so one of the other children's writers said, well, we're children's writers, sir. And the Duke of Edinburgh sort of looked a little bored, shall we say, and trying to make a joke of it, said to the other set of people, do you do something more intelligent? At which we all laughed, because it wasn't meant in a nasty way. It was just snapping at something to try and make a little joke of it. And we all felt quite proud to have been put down by the Duke.
Well,
if
you, as long as you saw the humour in it, I think that's the main thing. Oh, that's gas. Brilliant, brilliant.
If you're a children's author, you learn to have a thick skin, because we've all done the rounds of going to schools and people say, oh, what a pity we couldn't have had somebody like J.K. Rowling or Philip Pullman. But never mind, we've got you.
Oh, my gosh. And you, who's written 100 and left. This is 112 books, is it? Is this number 112?
It is 112. Yes, I can't believe that I've written them all somehow.
Oh my gosh. Well, we better talk about it. I'm looking at it here and it's fabulous. It's a beautiful hardback book. The cover is stunning. So tell us about it. It's The Runaway Girls. The storyline revolves around two young girls from very different backgrounds.
Yes, one Lucy is very rich and the other Kitty is very poor. They meet by chance. It's 1851, the year of the Great British Exhibition in London. And in those days, it was still perfectly possible in Victorian London for street children just to be there. Nobody rounded them up or took them to orphanages or whatever. And these children actually try to make a living for themselves by busking on the streets and decide that the Great Exhibition might be a very good place where they would find crowds with lots of money in their pockets and purses, and so it is. Mm. But they get into all sorts of different adventures too. I think that the ideal thing about Victorian literature is that you can do things that you can't in modern books, because if I wrote about modern children running away in Ireland or England, it would be a much more worrying book. It would be a book where it would be so frightening to the thought of very young girls out on the streets by themselves. Somehow or other, because it's at such a distance, and most people have some awareness of books like Charles Dickinson's Oliver Twist, we sort of take it for granted that, that, yes, there were these poor children, and yes, we can worry about them and feel for them, but hopefully it doesn't frighten any child too much. And I do take pains to make a happy ending for them.
Mm. And you've always, with your writing, I mean, you've wanted to write books for children, you know, that children actually think about and have issues like divorce and adoption and mental illness. And as you say, write them in a way that's not scary, that's accessible and generally has the happy ending.
I remember when I was a child, I mean, I read Enid Blyton, say, like most of my generation, and I liked her books, but I always felt they were so, everything that happened to the children was exciting, but the children never squabbled, really. They never had parents who were having lots of rows. They never had any money problems. And, you know, I couldn't help feeling then that this isn't what my life is like, or an awful lot of children that I knew. And I made this sort of rather pompous little resolution that if ever I was lucky enough to get a book published myself when I was grown up, I'd make sure my children reflected my sort of life and would be comforting to any child that didn't have, you know, lovely, rich parents and a very happy lifestyle. And I sort of, I mean, how lucky I am that I managed to actually achieve that ambition, because so many children have, you know, they want to be ballet dancers or rock stars or nowadays influencers. And yet not all of us can manage to be these things. But thank goodness I did.
There you go. And I mean, so many people, so many of us who are adults now would have read your Tracy Beaker series, which is still so beloved by people. And it's, are you finding now that the second generation of readers, moms handing books down, is happening all the time?
It is. And sometimes when in more normal times, I can actually do events face to face with people and then sign books. It's happened quite a lot now that there will be a sort of eager child of 7 or 8 and an eager mum who says, I read your books when I was younger. And sometimes they've even kept the book and said, look, can you sign it again for my daughter now? Mm. And it's just very touching. I absolutely love it.
And how has COVID been for you creatively, Jacqueline? Like, you've got this done now. What's in the pipeline next?
I've got a new book coming out in September. September, and I'm already nearly finished the one afterwards. I found it really quite useful because normally I'm quite busy going out and about and talking about my books and getting involved in various different committees and things. Now, I've mostly stayed at home, and so I've had more time for writing, more time for reading, and even more time for taking my dog for a long walk.
There you go.
I've been quite lucky in that respect, but I'm very much aware how frightening it must be for so many people. And, you know, if you've had a family who have had a tragedy, I mean, nothing could be worse. Mm. And at the moment, I'm having a lot of letters and emails from children who have really been frightened and depressed by everything and, you know, want an awful lot of reassurance because, of course, it's probably the first really dramatic, dreadful thing that's ever happened to them.
Yeah. So Jacqueline, I'm going to have to cut you off there because I've run out of time, but it was such a pleasure talking to you. The Runaway Girls by Jacqueline Wilson is published by Doubleday Children's and is out now. That is my lot for today. Thanks for your company this week. Ray is back on Monday. I'm off to the chippers. Sarah is next on Drive Time.
It's the Ray Dashie Show on RT Radio 1.